Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. This week, we're playing the recording of the last episode of Cheyenne Roundup. The podcast is a collaboration between Wyoming Public Media's and WyoFile's state government reporters and takes a look at what's happening in the Wyoming State House during the legislative session. WyoFile's state government reporter Maggie Mullen and Wyoming Public Media's Chris Clements and David Dudley welcome special guest Bob Beck and a live audience for this extended overview of what turned out to be an unusual 2024 budget session.
It's worth mentioning that, you know, a lot of the divide on the budget, but also just throughout the session in general, that was mostly split between the two factions of the Republican Party.
That's up next on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
If you're searching for a break from the news, look no further than Wyoming Public Media. We provide three music channels for whatever may be your taste or mood: Classical Wyoming, Jazz Wyoming, and Wyoming Sounds. You can find them all on a variety of platforms for listening, including streaming, Wyoming Public Radio app, smart speakers, and FM radio. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and listen.
It is a joy to have Wyoming news, to enjoy Wyoming kind of music directed to a Wyoming type of culture, familiar voices.
I think Wyoming is lucky to have this. I think Wyoming appreciates it, and I think it's been supported in ways that testify to that.
Those were two brothers, Al and Pete. They made testimonials in appreciation of Wyoming Public Radio. You can join Al and Pete Simpson with a testimonial of your own. It's easy, and you can get the hang of it by going to our website and finding out more about our I Love Wyoming Public Radio campaign. Just go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and join the folks who are letting their voices be heard.
Welcome to a live recording of the Cheyenne Roundup, a weekly look at Wyoming's legislative session from Wyoming Public Media and WyoFile. I'm Maggie Mullen, WyoFile's state government and politics reporter, joined by Wyoming Public Media state government team, Chris Clements and David Dudley. As our listeners probably know, the legislative session ended 2 weeks ago, but we wanted to give Governor Mark Gordon a chance to work through the pile of bills that was sitting on his desk before we did our wrap-up show. His deadline to veto bills was Saturday, so we can now say for certain what from the session made it into law and what didn't. And we have a special guest today, too, veteran Wyoming politics reporter and former Wyoming Public Media News Director Bob Beck, here to help us make sense of what was a pretty unusual session. Welcome, Bob.
Thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure being back.
Now, Bob, I bet most people listening know who you are, but for those who don't, you retired in 2022 after 34 years with Wyoming Public Radio. And throughout your career, you closely followed Wyoming politics. So do you miss covering the legislative session?
No, I really haven't, Maggie. And I'm delighted that I don't have to, but I can just join you here at the end of the session. I started covering it in 1985 under Governor Ed Hirschler. And, you know, I think that's probably enough fun for just about anybody. So, you know, I have moved on with my life. I'm here in Syracuse teaching Syracuse University students about broadcast journalism, although I might add there's plenty of lobbying going on from them when it comes to grades and things like that. So,
well, it's great to have you back as our guest moderator.
All right. Well, it's my pleasure. And I'd also like to welcome our live audience joining us via Zoom. Great to have a lot of folks join us on a Monday morning after a very big weekend. Governor took a lot of action. We'll be touching on that in just a second. Now, I want to mention that if anybody wants to join in on the conversation, there are some audience questions you can submit at any point using the Q&A function. So just simply send those and we'll address those towards the end. So thank you very much for joining us. Big ticket item, of course, during the budget session.
session. We'll get to that in just a second. Let's talk about some other bills. You know, one of the things I loved about living in Wyoming was access to the outdoors. Chris, you followed efforts to clarify management of Wyoming Outdoor Recreation and the Tourism Fund. What were the details on that bill, and why does that one matter?
Yeah, Bob, the Outdoor Rec Fund was actually created through legislation that passed last session. And this year's bill was kind of meant to determine guidelines for how the state's now going to manage it. Now that the governor has signed it, the fund will have $6 million to distribute every 2 years to grants for things like building trails and boat ramps. And tribal governments and nonprofits are just a few of the organizations that are all now going to be able to apply for that funding.
So the Outdoor Rec Trust Fund was something the governor did sign. Let's pivot to one of his early vetoes. That was, for those of you scoring at home, Senate File 61. David, this bill would have given charter schools the ability to apply for status as local education agencies. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so Senator Driscoll pushed for this bill. He told me that it was not worth a veto. I reached out to some charter school leaders in the area, and I did not hear back on why they might have wanted it or why they might not have wanted it. My understanding is that if the bill did pass, school leaders would have been able to apply directly for federal grants. But the governor said that that would have undermined the charter school authorizing board's ability to hold charter schools accountable. So one of the reasons he shut it down was because he wanted that board to get up and running before a new law undercut their ability to function.
Okay, sticking with education and moving to a controversial bill that the governor did let go into law, but with the line item veto. David, tell us what happened with the education savings account legislation.
Yeah, so that was an interesting bill, you know, and there was a mirror bill earlier in the session that was killed. This education bill went through round after round of negotiation. You know, many of my sources expected it to fail, but then it passed. And then it sat on Governor Gordon's desk until Thursday evening. He signed that bill, but he raised constitutionality concerns and issued a line item veto to narrow eligibility for those education savings accounts to lower income earning families. Before the veto, most Wyoming families were eligible for public funds to pay for private education, be that parochial school, private school, or homeschooling expenses. But like, for instance, a family of four earning up to $150,000 a year, they would have been eligible for that assistance under a previous draft, and that's where the constitutionality came into question. My understanding is that that veto was an attempt to bring the bill more in line with the Wyoming Constitution, which prohibits the state from giving money to individuals, and here I'm quoting, except for the necessary support of the poor. Gordon noted, but he did not deal with the risk of violating a different part of the Wyoming Constitution, which prohibits the allocation of public funds to sectarian and religious organizations like church schools, for instance.
Well, another issue that's become a staple are topics surrounding abortion. Despite the ongoing court case concerning the legislature's two abortion bans, lawmakers passed yet another abortion bill this session, but this one didn't make it to the governor's desk. Chris, why did Gordon veto House Bill 148?
So House Bill 148 is kind of distinct from last session's abortion bills in that it wasn't an outright ban. So it would have required clinics that provide abortions to be licensed as ambulatory surgical centers, and clinics would have needed to get hospital admitting privileges for their doctors. And the bill also had an amendment that required fetal ultrasounds for women at least 48 hours before being able to get medication for an abortion. And Gordon was clear that while, you know, he supports banning abortion, he said additional litigation over House Bill 148 was also likely to get tied up in the courts and could stall any potential resolution there.
Staying with the topic of bills that could get tied up in court, Gordon on Friday signed a ban on gender-affirming care for Wyoming youth, but he also called out lawmakers for their inconsistency on parental rights. Chris, what is the backstory there?
Yeah, so with this bill, Senate File 99, it bars young people in Wyoming from accessing gender-affirming treatments like puberty blockers, hormone therapy, or surgeries. That's even though gender-affirming surgeries for minors are not performed in the state. I mean, in short, the legislature decided what kinds of medical care is appropriate for kids rather than just leaving it up to parents. So while Gordon, you know, he said he signed the bill because of the protections it includes for children, he also characterized it as, you know, quote, straying into the personal affairs of families, unquote. So he chastised lawmakers as well for their inconsistency when it comes to parental rights. And that's because they passed legislation strengthening parental rights in education, like in the case of Senate File 9, but they didn't extend parental rights to healthcare decisions for kids struggling with gender dysphoria, as in the case of Senate File 99. So the gender-affirming care ban that Gordon signed, it goes into effect in July, but it's worth noting that a federal judge blocked enforcement of a similar ban in Idaho last year. And I know that Wildfile reporter Madeline Beck and I are going to be watching for, you know, similar lawsuits here in Wyoming.
You know, I think it's worth noting, and this happens, it seems to me, every year, that the more controversial bills were sponsored by individual lawmakers as opposed to being what we call committee bills. Committee bills are crafted during the interim where lawmakers, they'll have plenty of time to study the issues, take testimony, that sort of thing. And historically, those are the bills that had more success. Maggie, welcome to the 2024 session. Those bills had a little more trouble, especially on one side, the House.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and that was true from day one. In fact, that was an incredibly deadly day for committee bills in the House. And to remind folks real quickly, budget sessions have unique rules, including one rule that requires all bills except for the budget to receive 2/3 support in an introductory vote. So it's a pretty high initial hurdle to clear. And there's been a long tradition, though, in the legislature that because committee bills get that extra work and attention, that they get that initial approval. And that way, lawmakers can at least debate those bills properly on the floor during committee of the whole and second and third reading. But on day one in the House, 13 committee bills failed introduction. And that was thanks to members of the hardline Freedom Caucus. Their ranks have grown large enough now that they have enough members to essentially veto any House bill upon introduction because of that 2/3 rule. And they didn't hesitate to use that power this session.
However, the property tax reform measures were spared from the bill massacre. Why did that happen? And could you explain that?
Yeah, the tone definitely changed on day two, and that was largely when House leadership put their foot down, and more specifically, that was Majority Floor Leader Chip Nyman. But what's interesting about that is Nyman is a Freedom Caucus member, and he stood up ahead of votes on property tax bills and essentially asked his peers to give legislation the green light after his own caucus wielded its veto power not 24 hours before then. And other lawmakers were, you know, quick to point out this sort of apparent contradiction. Ultimately, property tax reform was spared on introduction, and lawmakers ended up sending 5 property tax relief bills to the governor's desk. In fact, property tax was one area where lawmakers, in a very contentious session, were largely unified. And Gordon signed all but one of those into law. Altogether, the legislation creates new exemptions for senior citizens. It doubles an existing exemption for veterans. It also caps annual increases, and it expands eligibility for a state refund program that's already on the books. That was largely successful last year.
Again, stay with us. And I should mention to our listeners, thanks so much for joining us. If you have a question, we're going to take some of those questions at the end of this discussion. They're in the Q&A function. Just simply write your question there, and we'll be delighted to get to it.
Join us for the newsroom from the BBC, and we'll bring you a fresh and lively look at what's happening in the world. Using our extensive network of correspondents, we take you to the story as it breaks. Get the facts and hear the experts on the newsroom from the BBC.
Weeknights at 7 on Wyoming Public Radio, followed by Classical Wyoming from 8 to 11. Wyoming Public Radio takes you around Wyoming. Listen for interesting stories from down the long streets and around the state.
around Wyoming, weekday mornings at 6:06 and 8:06, and afternoons at 1:30 and 4:48. If you have a Wyoming story of interest, you can send it to me at ingel@uwyo.edu. Thanks.
Gonna talk about the budget with Maggie in just a second, but oh, by the way, there was another little bill that got some attention. It would have repealed gun-free zones. Now, the bill died, was resurrected, heavily amended. Many years ago, Governor Meade vetoed a similar bill. David, what did Governor Gordon decide to do with this?
Gordon rejected the bill that would have allowed people with concealed carry permits to bring firearms into most public spaces overseen by the state. In his veto letter, Gordon said House Bill 125 eroded local control and allowed the legislature to, quote, micromanage a constitutionally protected right, unquote. He said it also violated the Wyoming Constitution.
David, can I go off script with you for just a quick second and ask you a follow-up question to that? One of the things that seemed to me that got them into trouble was keeping the schools in there, the education K-12, the University of Wyoming, certainly. Do you think this bill might have gotten through the governor's desk if those issues were taken out of it?
It's really hard to say because they argued a lot about the idea that people could bring firearms to hospitals. There was a lot of nervousness around the idea that people would bring weapons onto hospital grounds, onto school grounds. So there was a lot of back and forth. And to be honest with you, I'm surprised it passed after all the back and forth. And one of the comments that I heard that really resonated with me was a representative who was speaking against the bill asked, "What happens when we send a police officer or many officers to a school where there's an active shooting event, right? What happens when the police get there, and now instead of one active shooter, there are multiple active shooters? How do the police tell one from the other? And you know,
who's the good guy and who isn't? That kind of thing.
Yeah, that's right. So really contentious bill. Again, I'm surprised to have seen it passed.
When Governor Meade vetoed it in 2017, he suggested that a committee study the issue and bring it back for possibly more thoughtful legislation. I'll be interested to see if lawmakers actually try and take that approach and add it to their committee list. Any thoughts from any of you on whether or not that might be something leadership would consider doing? Maggie?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's definitely a possibility. I think there were also concerns from some that, you know, spend the session at the Capitol that, you know, that kind of bill was an interesting choice for lawmakers who were, you know, having a hard time getting along.
That's an excellent point. So nowhere was that tension more apparent than with budget negotiations. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And what set the tone for those negotiations, at least in the Senate, that also came on day one. Day one was very interesting in the legislature, if folks hadn't already picked up on that. But day one in the Senate, lawmakers voted 17-14 to override Senate President Ogden Driscoll. And more specifically, they voted to reinstate Senator Dave Kinski as chair of the Senate Appropriations Committee. And that was after Driscoll had demoted him last year when there were concerns over that Kinski wasn't up to the task. And so these were kind of long simmering tensions that came up on the very first day. And then there were a string of late nights in both the House and the Senate when a record number of amendments were filed. And ultimately that landed the two chambers about $1.1 billion apart. And then, of course, there's reconciliation. And when that came up, the first group of negotiators failed. Basically, the House made the first move. They put an offer on the table, but then it sat out for about 4 days over the weekend. And when the Senate side responded, led by Senator Dave Kinski, the House called a stalemate and walked out on negotiations. So a second set of negotiators were sent to do the job. That time, they were led by Senator Tara Nethercutt, who had been chair of Senate Appropriations after Kinski was demoted. But that also didn't go over smoothly at the beginning, because when Driscoll brought a motion to appoint the second set of negotiators, Senator Larry Hicks brought a motion to challenge him. Ultimately, that motion failed, and lawmakers returned to the bargaining table. And then from there, it went smoothly for about the next 24 hours. In fact, they were able to strike a deal in that amount of time, which was a lot quicker than, you know, how negotiations had been going. At that point, the bill went back to both chambers for final approval. And that's when folks, you know, those sort of concerns about a failed budget were heightened. In the House, it passed pretty easily. In the Senate, it passed just barely. The final vote was 17 to 14, which was almost identical to the vote to override Driscoll on day one. But three lawmakers switched over.
Interesting. Lot happening there. And Senator Kinski, congratulations to him for setting the all-time record for being replaced as a chairman of a committee throughout a session. So good work by him. But now let me ask you a real question. What was the tension about in the budget? What were the problems? I mean, what was going on, or was it just some of the political strife we've been talking about?
That's a good question. I would say it's a little bit of both. For example, it's worth mentioning that, you know, a lot of the divide on the budget, but also just throughout the session in general, that was mostly split between the two factions of the Republican Party. So there's the Freedom Caucus and their allies, which are the more hardline Republicans. And then there's the Wyoming Caucus and their allies, which are the more traditional Republicans. And as far as specific items in the budget go, there was a lot of tension around school construction. And what's interesting about that is the fact that funding for a new high school in Rock Springs, in fact, helped convince those three swing votes in the Senate to support the budget bill. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, a lot of it is about policy and a lot of it is driven by policy. But at the end of the day, these are people with relationships, and that human side obviously comes out in various ways.
Governor took a lot of actions. Maybe we'll touch on that a little more specifically in just a moment. But a couple of the vetoes, and the governor, when there's money in a budget bill or any bill, he can do a line item veto, which he certainly took advantage of on Saturday. Looks like because they adjourned early, maybe the session is over, but it looks like there might be some trouble with the Freedom Caucus wanting to come back and revisit some of his vetoes, which were things that they truly wanted. What's going on there? Will that happen? What do you think?
Well, so the Freedom Caucus would like to attempt to override a few of Gordon's vetoes, which a special session would, in fact, allow that group of lawmakers to do that. And Freedom Caucus Chairman Representative John Baer, he has his eye on reversing several of Gordon's actions, specifically on the gun-free zone bill, abortion restrictions, as well as in the budget. Governor Gordon line item vetoed some but not all of the amendment having to do with diversity, equity, inclusion at UW. And the legislature met for the full 20 days of the budget session. I think there's some misunderstanding about whether or not they adjourned early. They met for the full 20 days, but Baer has accused leadership of adjourning early since there were technically three extra days available to them because they adjourned early in the 2023 session. But I should mention that the Freedom Caucus did not oppose adjournment. And in fact, it was Freedom Caucus member and Majority Floor Leader Chip Nyman in the House that brought the motion to adjourn. But nonetheless, Baer characterized adjournment in a press release as, quote, an open invitation to Governor Gordon to veto measures important to the people of Wyoming with no recourse, unquote. And for the Freedom Caucus, which, you know, one of their tenets is they really promote limited government spending. So it's interesting to see them, you know, advocate for the special session, which will cost the state. I've heard from leadership before that it would cost $100,000 a day. More recently, I heard from leadership that it would cost something like $35,000 a day. But nonetheless, if a special session happens, we can expect, you know, thousands of dollars to pay for it.
So since they had the three extra days, since they didn't use, because they have some extra days, I personally was shocked that they left town and let the governor to do whatever he wanted to do with the budget. Was there any discussion on why they did that?
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily on the floor, but I can tell you that what I was told was never underestimate a lawmaker's desire to go home at the end of session. And I think, you know, that probably played a role in why, you know, folks wanted to call it a day. And I think for a lot of lawmakers, they felt like, you know, they had gone down there and completed the work. And it was a little bit surprising that they didn't use those extra 3 days. But again, you know, towards the end of session, I think folks are just kind of ready to go home.
All right. And the other part of this, so to override a veto, both the House and the Senate has to have 2/3 vote. Then this was part of my thinking, too. That's maybe why they left. They didn't think there was any way they would overturn some of these vetoes. Realistically, Maggie, is there a chance they would get 2/3 and deal with the DEI stuff and some of those other things? Because those seem to be, especially on the House side, much closer votes.
Yeah, I mean, I think if they end up down in Cheyenne specifically to deal with the governor's overrides or governor's vetoes, you know, it's worth mentioning that, you know, both the House and the Senate, when it came to at least, you know, the gun-free zone bill and the abortion bill, that, you know, those passed with considerable support. Obviously, the question now is there enough support for a special session? At this point, we can at least say, you know, as of this morning, leadership, as in, you know, House Speaker Albert Summers and Senate President Ogden Driscoll, that leadership is not interested in a special session. And that's for a number of reasons. Part of it is the cost, as we mentioned a little bit, but also the effectiveness. For example, because the legislature adjourned sine die, the special session wouldn't just be a matter of them coming back. A special session would mean starting over with those bills. Those bills would have to move through the typical legislative process. We're talking about introduction. We're talking about moving through committee and through the chambers and through reconciliation. That is, unless, you know, the rules were suspended. So we know for a fact that leadership is not interested in a special session, but it remains to be seen if membership as a whole wants to make that happen. And as I understand it, if enough members request a poll, and that would be virtual, so traditionally they've held that over email, if enough members ask for a poll, leadership has to hold a poll. Now, it would only take a simple majority in that poll to convene a special session. So I think it's something we're going to keep an eye on, and we might know more as soon as, you know, later today.
All right. Well, that's one to be keeping an eye on.
And just an update. Since the recording of this live webinar, lawmakers are weighing the prospect of a special session. They have called for a vote, and lawmakers have till Sunday at 5 p.m. to cast a vote for or against a special session. In a joint op-ed written on Wednesday, Senate President Ogden Driscoll and House Speaker Albert Summers said a special session would likely run between 8 and 10 days, and it would cost the state $35,000 per day. They wrote they would potentially be in favor of a special session if they could focus solely upon Senate File 54. That was a property tax exemption bill vetoed last week by Governor Gordon. It would have cut 25% off assessed single-family home values up to $2 million. The legislative leaders said they will be a no vote as they didn't want a special session to focus on issues that the Wyoming Freedom Caucus brought up.
A new season of The Modern West is coming your way. This time, Wyoming Public Radio reporters dig into stories from across the West.
We are traveling since Patagonia in Chile, and we're going to Alaska.
It's like two worlds that don't understand each other.
I really do believe courage is like a muscle.
High Altitude Tales. It's season 8 of The Modern West. Catch the trailer now under podcasts at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
Did you know that all 6 episodes of Human Nature's latest season are out right now? That's right. Season 9 of our award-winning podcast has a little bit of everything. A Wyoming man who spent his summer working as a night shepherd in Switzerland.
All I could hear was my breathing and the steps, and everything was so dark. And I just thought, okay, this must be what it's like to be an astronaut on the moon.
the story of one of the biggest animal rescues in history.
And I picked up the phone and they said, when can you get here? And so the next day, I actually took a plane because it never occurred to me what was ahead for me over the next few weeks.
And a woman who followed the gray whale migration hundreds of miles with her son.
I was exhausted one evening, fed up of trying to work. I'd had a really bad day. And so I was like, right, I'm not working. I'm going to read about whales.
Find Human Nature on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Human Nature, one word, one N.
Again, if you have a question for any of our reporters, you can go to the Q&A function, ask it, and we're going to actually jump to those here in just a second. What we'll do, folks, is I will read the questions out loud, and we'll see if the appropriate people would like to answer. And but before we get there, I did want to quickly ask David and Chris, for those of us who have been around a while, these types of sessions maybe have become more commonplace. I was kind of curious, Chris, starting with you, what you took away from the legislature. Did it seem like a wild place, or was it sort of what you expected?
I think somehow, if I could say, it's both. I mean, I expected a degree of wildness, I would say, with being here in Wyoming and just hearing a little bit about the House Freedom Caucus and the kind of the numbers that they have in the legislature. I've lived in quite a few states that, like Alabama and Arizona, that have conservative legislatures. So some of the talking points I heard from lawmakers did not necessarily shock or surprise me. They just sounded a little bit like, reused from more national figures there, honestly.
That's funny. If you've been in the big time with those two states, there's no question about that. David, what were your takeaways? What did you think?
Well, I covered the legislature in Utah, which, another very conservative state. A lot of, as Chris just mentioned, a lot of these bills, they did sound like they were coming from the national conversation rather than the local conversation. And sometimes, whenever I hear certain accusations about, take your pick where culture wars are concerned, I ask myself, is there hard evidence that this kind of thing exists here in Wyoming? And I don't always find it. And I reach out to as many sources as possible. My last question to any source is always, who should I speak to next about this subject? They don't really have a lot of hard evidence for me, for the work that I do.
Yeah, that's been happening a lot in recent years where the national issues are being brought in here, and frankly, not a lot of it has ever applied to Wyoming. All right, let's take some audience questions. First one, do you think that some of the individual lawmakers' bills were used to position themselves for a run for higher office? Governor is put in parentheses in this question, with the bills also putting Governor Gordon in a box. Maggie, you want to handle that one for us?
Sure. I guess to answer the question, I mean, we can at least say that that's the impression that Governor Gordon at least seems to have. It was when his veto letter for the one property tax bill that he vetoed, he used the expression election exuberance. And so the governor sort of felt like, some lawmakers may have been using this session to campaign or to position themselves in a certain way to benefit themselves at the ballot box. But, he sort of felt like that's not always, that's not a wise way to legislate, in his view, particularly when it comes to something like property taxes, when, dipping into that, as we all know, can put local governments in a bind because that's their revenue stream. So we can at least say for sure that the governor seems to have the impression that, there were lawmakers that were maybe thinking more about, their reelection than, what was maybe the best solution for some of these issues.
All right. Next question. In such a contentious session, how did it affect reporting? Did you feel hostility from legislators or the public? And if so, are there any legislative rules or laws that could help protect the actual media reporters. And thanks for all you do from the listener. And David, do you want to try this one first?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, I think anytime you're dealing with either city government, state government, there's almost always the opportunity for hostility between elected officials, between elected officials and the public occasionally. You know, and as a reporter, my approach is always I'm respectful to everybody, right? It's just common courtesy, common decency. And I haven't really experienced legislators being nasty to me. You know, and I also report from a nonpartisan perspective, so I don't come in with certain ideas that I'm testing. I'm trying to get the facts of the story, and I expect everyone to offer those, you know, in the same spirit with which I'm offering my questions and my inquiries. As far as protecting us, you know, there are laws in place, I'm sure. I'd like to know more about that from my editors, my leadership, just what legislative rules are in place. But, you know, I luckily have not had to rely upon those things. I just approach everybody with respect, and so far it's served me well.
Did you deal with any hostility from the public, Chris, or the legislature?
No, not yet. But, you know, something that this question makes me think of is just working on my you know, stories on Chloe's Law or Senate File 99, the gender-affirming care ban, talking to Senator Anthony Bouchard about, you know, he was the bringer of that bill. And it was interesting to, before the interview, you know, do a deep dive on his social media and see that he's calling, you know, my colleagues here at the radio station scumbags, leftist trolls, you know, and really slandering a lot of different news outlets on social media. And then to interview him in person, and he was just, you know, just a normal, decent person. And I think that just goes to show that, like, as a reporter, like, when you turn up with a mic in hand in person, it's harder to, you know, it's harder to be that kind of antagonistic to people, I think, especially in a leadership position as they are.
Mm-hmm. Maggie, you had your hand up. Go ahead.
Yeah. I was going to make that point before Chris did. You know, I think it's harder to act that way in person. In fact, there are several lawmakers that throughout the interim or the off season won't return my calls, won't return my emails. But when I'm there in Cheyenne, they're usually happy to talk in person. But same sort of goes, I think, for some of the hostility. I mean, it's sort of funny to see the way that plays out differently at the legislature. And I'm just speaking of my own experience. I know that might not be true for all reporters at the Capitol, but, it's definitely interesting to see that distinction between what they're willing to say online and what they're willing to tell voters and then how they actually interact with us.
Okay. Let's see. What do we make of Governor Gordon's line item vetoing Representative, and I thought this was amusing myself, vetoing Representative Haroldson's water tank and Senator Salazar's Riverton Health Center after they voted against the budget? So they had amendments in there for these things. What kind of message was Governor Gordon sending? So let's see. David, you want to try this one to begin with?
Yeah, so I actually just spoke to Rep. Haroldson this morning, and you know he was taken aback by the veto, and I mean really, you know, kind of disturbed by it, and you know he says that he believes that it's a personal attack against him. He even pointed to the language that the governor used in the veto letter, and he kind of broke it down for me. So, you know, he's definitely not happy about that veto. And, you know, he has good reason, I think, to some extent, because, you know, I was just up there in Wheatland last week. And, you know, there are a lot of people in the vicinity of that water tank. In fact, right at the base, there's a whole row of mobile homes right at the base. And those folks they're worried about the tank collapsing and flooding the community. So it's a tricky situation for sure.
Yeah, and that's, I think the point is maybe if you're going to have an amendment in there, you should actually vote for the bill. Maggie, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one other thing I would add to that is, you know, in some of my reporting after the session, you know, talking to some longstanding members about, you know, votes against the budget. And while, you know, Representative Haroldson is not on the Appropriations Committee, you know, I heard from several lawmakers that, you know, have been in the body for a long time. It felt really important for them to point out that, you know, members of the Appropriations Committee, so now, you know, the chair of the Appropriations Committee in the Senate, voting against the budget is very unusual and is also a pretty new phenomenon. That's something that one lawmaker actually pointed out to me, a former Senator Nicholas, not to be confused with Bob Nicholas, but I can't remember their first name. You probably do, Bob.
Phil? Yes.
Yeah, yes. So,
that's his brother. Yes.
Yes. So back when he was, you know, Senate chair of appropriations or chair of Senate appropriations, you know, this lawmaker, this was Senator Guru, or maybe it was Senator Rothfuss. I can't quite remember. But, you know, both of them had been in the body for a while, particularly Rothfuss. But what they described to me was, you know, when that person was chair of appropriations, they stood on the Senate floor and they advocated for the budget bill, even if personally they did not agree with every item in it. So this sort of change in appropriation members, not only voting against the budget, but, you know, advocating against it is something that's new to this body.
Yeah, traditionally what would happen is the chairs of the committee, they would hold the line, and the whole goal was to not let amendments get passed, keep things out of it, keep that budget bill clean. We worked very hard on it. This is what the way we want to do it, and they would fight against just about every single amendment that would go in there. And I think that's your point is well taken by the senators, is that you saw a lot of changes show up, especially on the Senate side, when they were trying to change rules and all kinds of things right there at the end. And I thought Senator Nethercott at the end of the session maybe had an excellent point where she said, yeah, maybe these changes are okay, but to do it now at the 11th hour is not the way to do this. Bring a bill. Let's have some discussion. And this goes back to so many points, whether it's the gun issue or whatever it is. If I think they would study some of these things, bring them up, take debate during the session, you might actually get a good bill that, you know, is ready for prime time and doesn't get vetoed at the end of the session. But just my take on that matter.
You already listen to public radio, but what if public radio could listen back? It does on the NPR One app. Hear local, national, and international news plus podcasts based on what you like. The more you listen, the more it gets to know you. Download NPR One at your app store.
From sunrise to sunset, spring to winter, Wyoming Public Radio is here for you. Support this 24-hour statewide service by becoming a new member at $5 or $10 a month. Click the donate button at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
This is a question. Seems to me, as Wyoming legislature focuses more and more on culture wars issues, that the quality of those elected has declined. By quality, it seems these individuals have less understanding and input on the complexities of running the state. As an indicator, it appears some of the people that understood the government have already announced they're not running. Senator Ellis, Baldwin, Representative Western. Any thoughts on that trend? Chris, you want to start?
Sure, Bob. You know, I can't necessarily speak to the historical trend, just being a relative newcomer to reporting on the legislature. But to your point, this question, I think, is kind of asking about, like, yeah, I would say, and I'd love to hear what others think, just that in general, it did feel to me like there was kind of a prioritization of some individual bringers of bills that were maybe more like what you would call like a social wedge issue bill, like an abortion restrictions bill or the gender affirming care ban. Those were kind of, it felt maybe like prioritized or sort of the docket was flooded with those, as opposed to the committee bills, which were a number of them were killed right away by the House Freedom Caucus. So, I mean, that kind of stood out to me. And I do think that it does change the way that the legislature operates. I mean, I think it means that basically a lot of bills are going to die and there's a lot to do, you know, in already a short amount of time. So, yeah, that's my two cents.
Maggie or David, either one of you?
I mean, I can jump in. I mean, I would also note that, if I'm remembering this right, sometimes the sessions all kind of bleed together, but for a lot of these lawmakers, this was their first budget session. I want to say, like, that's true of a lot of the House, and as any of us reporters can attest, it's a steep learning curve. I mean, I'm still learning. This was my third session, so as far as, you know, whether or not this is a body that is still learning the process, I think that's true, but I think that was probably true in, you know, years before when there were, you know, a large portion of new lawmakers. And that might be true again, depending on how this election goes. You know, if there are a lot of freshmen in either body, it's, I guess, more likely to happen in the House, you know, they kind of start that learning process all over again. So I guess I would just add that, you know, we have a lot of folks that this is their first term in the legislature.
David, anything to add to that?
Yeah, again, it's a tricky thing, right? One of the things that I hold on to is when I think of government and what I as a citizen expect from government is, you know, I want to see the roads paved. I want to see the sewers working. I want to have clean drinking water. And so going into a budget session, you know, I'm looking personally, again, as a citizen, I'm looking at those things. A lot of these social wedge issues, I think they're interesting because they tend to be brought forward by representatives, senators, lawmakers, who tend to want, they talk a lot about the proper role of government. They want to keep government small. They want to keep the government out of our personal lives. But a lot of these bills, I think, center upon our personal lives. So especially going into a budget, I'm asking myself, well, why is this bill even here during this session?
Okay. Who can explain to us what happens now with DEI at the university? I know the trustees had a meeting on this this past week. My understanding is that they're going to take a look at maybe taking state money out of those efforts. But which one of you can handle what might happen now? And the governor did, in fact, veto that language, correct, Maggie?
Yes, he vetoed at least part of it, and it's too bad our colleague Madeline Beck, not related to Bob Beck, by the way, but our colleague Madeline Beck,
she would be delighted to be related, though, I think.
She went to that meeting last week and would be able to give the most thorough answer, but I guess what I can tell folks is that the trustees met last week, and as far as the trustees go, they expressed support for DEI programming at the university and the office. And then, of course, Governor Gordon came in and he vetoed a portion of the amendment. And that was just the language that would prohibit funding from going, which I had in front of me, but just the programming. So his veto did not deal with the office. But then you also have President Seidel, who seems to be coming from a different direction than the trustees, because the day after, maybe it was the morning of Governor Gordon's line item vetoes, he came out with a press release sort of signaling that, you know, he thanked the governor, but said, you know, we're really thinking about the will of the legislature and we're going to have to make some changes. So, there's a lot of players involved, and it seems like not everyone is quite on the same page.
Here's a question. Have there been more vetoes in recent legislative sessions in contrast to the sessions in the past? And does this reflect current polarization in politics? Now, there was one where maybe I could provide some minor assistance with trying to think. You know, I do know that Governor Geringer was not afraid of using the veto pen back in the day, and I know Governor Sullivan did on a few issues. I don't know if I could honestly say if there were more vetoes this time than in the past. In fact, I would say that maybe there have been a couple of governors in the past that did more. But it's always those contentious issues. And if you're picking an issue that goes against the policies and the direction of the governor, that's when it'll do things. I will say that line item budget vetoes in the budget with different types of language dealing with the gender studies, the DEI, some of those things have always been vetoed by governors in the past. There was a time that somebody said that all Division I athletes who got scholarships for the University of Wyoming had to be from in-state. There was a governor that vetoed that. So there have been a wide range of things. And it's funny, it always seems to be the University of Wyoming who are directed to do something or another, and it gets line item vetoed. So I don't think it's any more than we've seen necessarily in the past, unless, Maggie, it seems like a lot to you. But it seems to me that this has been something governors have done for quite a long time.
Yeah, I would guess that you probably have more thorough perspective on that than I do.
David talked about not getting calls back after reaching out to some legislators, and Maggie mentioned she's not received responses from some legislators on questions she had. I know another reporter who's not received responses from legislators after reaching out many times after the session. What's going on? Maggie, this might be a better one for you since you've been around the longest.
Sure. I mean, the short answer is that's showbiz, baby. There's nothing that requires lawmakers to engage with the press. But I guess I guess to answer the question more thoroughly, I mean, yeah, that's just kind of the way it goes. Sometimes you don't always hear back from sources, or sources also have, you know, their own business to attend to. But I guess I would also just put this back to listeners or to voters. You know, you're going to have lawmakers knocking on your door this campaign season. And, you know, maybe you ask them, you know, when's the last time that you engaged with a member of the press, and how willing are you to give your time to journalists? Because I think the explanation that some lawmakers give as to why they don't speak to the press is, you know, they say, well, I talk to voters directly. But for most people, they don't have time to go to the Capitol. They don't have time to go to committee meetings. They're really relying on journalists to do that work for them. So, yeah, I would just encourage folks to, you know, ask any kind of candidate, you know, are you willing to engage with the press?
Yeah, and it's not unusual, I think, for legislators right after the session to not respond to you because, frankly, they've been away from their jobs for some time, and they're probably working 13, 14-hour days to get caught up with things, and I've never taken that personally. And, you know, really, when you're talking about during the session, it's just such a small handful of people that don't speak to you. It really, for the most part, I've never had any trouble talking to people from either side of the aisle, political spectrum. Yeah, are there about three or four that never spoke to me? I can certainly think of them, and there a couple of them are still there. But for the most part, most people are delighted, and frankly, it's to their benefit to talk to statewide media, in particular, like all the folks here on this discussion. So I don't know that it's a great problem, but I do know that sometimes they do disappear right after a session. Well, thanks so much for everyone joining us today. Great thanks to David, Chris, and Maggie, and all the good reporters who did such a tremendous job staying up late and bringing you the coverage. Trust me, I've been there many times, and you deserve kudos and some sort of a badge for surviving your first Wyoming legislative session. And thanks for dusting me off and bringing me back for this conversation, Maggie. It was fun to join all of you.
Well, thank you, Bob. You know, you brought some special sauce to this event. So thank you so much. And thanks to all the great questions from the audience. There were too many to answer today, but we'll keep your questions in mind for future reporting. And thanks for listening to the Cheyenne Roundup, your weekly look at what lawmakers were up to during the 2024 legislative session from Wyoming Public Media and WyoFile. Editing and producing by Tennessee Watson and Camila Kudelska. Follow our ongoing legislative coverage at wyomingpublicmedia.org and wyofile.com. Thanks for listening.